argument this afternoon. Donna, would you please call the case?
Yes. The court will now call the State of Texas versus Brandon Johnson. May it please the court that Matthew Whitten will argue for the state and Andrea Simmons will argue for the county.
But go ahead, counsel.
May it please the court. Counsel, thank you for inviting us here this afternoon to discuss our case with you. It's especially important in light of Heath coming down since the original briefing was done. The question in this case is whether the trial court abused its discretion when it exercised authority that it did not have to dismiss the indictment without the state's consent.
Why didn't have that authority after Heath?
Under Heath, the trial court has inherent authority to manage its docket. Nothing in Heath stands for the proposition that dismissal is part of that inherent authority. And as I'm going to discuss, it was not. Dismissal is a radical remedy that is reserved only for egregious, possibly ongoing types of due process violations. There were basically four things in this record that could potentially warrant or potentially support dismissal of the indictment. A due process violation for lost or destroyed evidence. Well, 3914 Heath, that's A. B, a due process violation for lost or destroyed evidence. C, a due process violation under Brady. Or D, which I'll discuss in order, maybe a speedy trial issue. This, for various reasons, B, C, and D are right out. The trial court expressly did not rule on D, the speedy trial violation, and for B and C, there were no due process violations, and even if it could be said that there were, they did not warrant dismissal of the indictment. That leaves us only with 3914 to analyze as a potential remedy following or dismissal as a potential remedy following Heath.
Are there any cases out there in the context of Brady that say that there can be a Brady violation prior to trial? That I mean, I think your argument was essentially that there's not a due process issue, at least as Brady is concerned, because there hadn't been a trial yet.
That is our argument. And you're right. Under Fellows, or let me start with Napper there. Under Napper and Fellows, what the court said, if I can get to there, is that Fellows quoted the Supreme Court and talked about Supreme Court precedent saying that Brady and the material exculpatory framework necessarily involves situations involving the discovery after trial of information that had been known to the prosecution but unknown to the defense and are likely to have affected the outcome. It also cited the Court of Criminal Appeals, where they said a determination in concerning materiality under Brady involves balancing the strength of that exculpatory evidence with the evidence that was presented to the fact finder that would support conviction. You can't make that determination unless evidence has been presented to the fact finder. And we don't have a record here. We don't know what the evidence is going to be when and if this case gets tried. Now, I would like to revisit that. Under Heath, though, A, Heath, B, C, and D out. Heath, nothing in Heath stands for the proposition that dismissal was warranted. There are two important distinctions I want to make, one of which I just mentioned. Materiality for 3914 is different in some sense from materiality for due process analysis. We know from Watkins that materiality for 3914 just means relevant. It just means something about the case, really. It doesn't even have to be admissible. Materiality for a due process violation, though, does involve something that's likely to affect the outcome. So I want to make that distinction before we talk about Heath. The other distinction I want to make is bad faith. We know that the Court of Criminal Appeals has held in Heath that bad faith is not required to say that a violation of 3914 has occurred. We know that. But bad faith is still required under a lost or destroyed evidence analysis for under a Youngblood analysis. And so those are two important distinctions. There's
no question there's a 3914 violation here.
None at all, Your Honor. We think the trial court got that right. The trial court understood, or I think anticipated, what the Court of Criminal Appeals said in Heath. Heath really has
does the Brady materiality standard even have any relevance anymore in this case?
Not in this case, no. There's no way to make that determination in this case. Heath really had two holdings that are relevant to this case. And the trial court anticipated them. The state's obligation to turn over evidence in a timely way, even things that that we didn't have at the DA's office, but that Lake Dallas PD did. Second, the state's obligation to ascertain what is in the possession of law enforcement. Clearly, in this case, that's a problem. There was a 3914 violation. We do not dispute that. The question, the specific question that this court will need to analyze then is this. Was dismissal authorized and appropriate under Heath because did the trial court not have inherent authority to dismiss the indictments without consent of the state? On these facts, it did not. We know from Mungia, we can take that case to understand some principles. We know from Mungia that there is no general authority to permit a trial court to dismiss an indictment without the state's consent. So there's no general inherent authority. We know that.
Where do those exceptions come from?
Those exceptions come from due process violations that are not otherwise able to be remediated. That's what that boils down to. It would have to be the kind of due process violation that is continuing, ongoing, willful, malicious, and it cannot be remedied. The record here does not support that. The record here shows that Lake Dallas PD.
Where does the malice come from? Why, you said it has to be a malicious act. Why does it have to be a malicious act?
It does not have to be a malicious act. I should have spoken more carefully there. But it does have to be something that is not able to be remedied. Even under, if we go to a Youngblood analysis, for instance, lost or destroyed evidence, the court in Napper actually said that something that is bad procedure, intentional, that sort of thing, would not support a finding of bad faith.
I agree about the lost evidence, but what about the evidence that's still in existence?
The evidence, could you be more clear?
What I'm saying is, if we accept that there was some lost evidence here, and
yes,
if we accept that the Youngblood standard still applies to mm-hmm. lost evidence,
mm-hmm.
okay, maybe there does have to be a showing of bad faith.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't translate to for the other evidence that's still in existence for 3914 violation. Standard do we apply there?
Right. So for 3914, the standard is, first of all, like I said, under 3914, we do not dispute that there's been a violation. And so the standard is, and the Heath court says, bad faith doesn't matter. It either happened or it didn't. It did. So the next question is, and the sole question is under 3914, did the trial court have inherent authority to dismiss the case? That's the question. And so under 3914, it did not. The real error that the trial court made was in that remedy. The trial court understood 3914, but didn't understand the remedy. The Heath court gave us very helpful guidance on what a trial court's inherent authority in this situation might be, and it turned to the civil rules of evidence.
Kind of.
It used it as a guide, as a suggestion. But of course, it left open the question of, could there be other things? The guidance we have is the Civil Rules of Evidence. In those cases, what you find in Rule 215.2 are rules about excluding evidence, preventing claims from being made, and even taking as established facts regarding the matter for which discovery was ordered. The trial court could have taken those actions here. There could have been could have said, okay, you know what? I'm going to issue a spoliation instruction. I'm going to exclude the state's evidence with respect to these jail calls. I'm going to let the defense use what they want, but if the state's trying to use it, I'm going to exclude that evidence because they were not turned over in a timely way. Those would have all been appropriate remedies under Heath. But there is no inherent authority to dismiss an indictment without the state's consent, and the case law gives us that guidance. The default...
Could dismiss it if it was necessary. I thought your argument in your reply brief was the trial court went too far because its action was not necessary to remove a constitutional taint.
Under a due process analysis, yes, that is true. Under a Heath analysis, the trial court did not have inherent authority, and we can turn to that due process guidance to understand what the trial court's inherent authority is. That is what we're saying. And the default, what Heath Court said, was the default under the guidance it's given us would have been something like exclusion of the evidence. That is what the trial court could have done here. The Heath Court, I do want to point out, was made a note of the fact that it didn't love that solution. It said that a continuance may have been more appropriate. We take no position on whether it would have been more appropriate here, but the sole question before that court, as the question before this court, was simply, did the trial court abuse its discretion by acting outside its inherent authority? I do want to briefly turn in my time.
The death penalty sanction argument's not in your brief, is it?
I'm sorry?
You're analogizing the trial court's action here to a death penalty sanction under the civil rules.
Yes. That is not in my reply brief.
Right.
No, that is not. I think after getting the dissent in Heath that came out very recently, and I've been able to make that argument.
I've got a question. You said a couple of times that there's no question there's a 3914 violation, but from this record, how can we tell what was lost, what was destroyed, or what was just there was a delay in producing it?
Well, that's
things like the trial court didn't even know.
That's a really good question. I don't know that on this record we can really tell. I think that what matters is not specific pieces of evidence. I think that once we have crossed that boundary into a 3914 violation, the question just then becomes, how did the trial court fashion a remedy? And did it act outside its inherent authority, which it did. I do want to address the speedy trial issue, if I may, very briefly. It is not properly before the court. It was not litigated below. There's no way to do a Barker analysis under that. And the trial court specifically declined to rule on that. Even if this court felt compelled to do a Barker analysis, though, it would weigh in favor of the state. There's no actual speedy trial motion on file on which to understand the complaints. What we know he was in jail for a very long time. So there probably would be a presumptive delay there at that point. But there are other Barker factors that weigh against the appellee, including the fact that a motion to dismiss instead of filing a motion for speedy trial and getting it weighs heavily against the appellee, as does the fact that he did not put on any evidence of how it affected him. There is maybe some argument in the record about how it did, but it would not lie. So to sum up, there was A, 3914, B, due process lost or destroyed, C, due process, Brady, and D, speedy trial. B, C, and D are out. That leaves A. The trial court acted outside of its inherent authority by dismissing. It should have taken a less drastic remedy because it was not authorized to dismiss without the state's consent. The state requests that the trial court reverse the trial court's order dismissing the indictment.
Good afternoon. May it please this honorable court, Mr. Witten. Thank you all for being here today and inviting us up to discuss this case. I do believe this case is of vital importance, especially since the State v. Heath opinion was determined. I think State v. Heath governs the case at issue, and that a lot of the case law that has previously been relied upon regarding a trial court's inherent authority, such as from State v. Mungia, is outdated and applied to the original Article 39.14 prior to the amendments by the Michael Morton Act in 2013. Having said that, I believe that State v. Heath, the purpose of the case was to provide some teeth and some repercussions to the Michael Morton Act since its enactment. Since its enactment, the amended Act 3914 did not include sanctions for any discovery violations. So as a result of that, we were left with a statute that was supposed to provide more broader discovery power for the defense in all criminal cases to level the battleground and require an ongoing duty of the state to timely turn over evidence relevant to their defense. I think the appellee's argument can be broken down into two different categories, or three, realistically, depending on the state's argument. I think the state first argued in their brief that this issue should have been brought, it should have been a continuance rather than a dismissal. And appellee would like to note for the record, at the any of the last two hearings that the trial court had regarding rampant violations of the discovery of discovery under 3914 by the state, that the state never requested a continuance in any of those cases. The trial court at one point prior to dismissing this case utilized a continuance for almost 5 month period. The trial court went on the record to state that they were making the he was granting the sua sponte. He was a note in his judicial docket entry that stated, as of today, the police department just turned over further evidence. This court, sua sponte, resetting this matter based on the evidentiary failings of the police department, taking into consideration Code of Criminal Procedure 2.1397 and Article 39.14. It was obvious that at that time, at the second trial date back in late August or September, the trial court was frustrated. The state was not, had not disclosed their evidence, in fact, was still making discovery to the state when they would show up to hearings. The court, frustrated that the state was not requesting a continuance, nor were they contending that they had completed discovery, was set in his own mind to correct the error by granting a continuance. The continuance was for almost 5 months. This set the case into January of the following year of 2024. Granted, the indictment in this case was filed in May of 2021. At the time we get to the dismissal in this case, the trial court has reset the case for almost 5 months. The state utilized only one continuance for an unavailability of a witness, and the defense counsel filed two motions to dismiss, arguing that they were not receiving the disclosures required under 3914. During the time after the court, in fact, continued the case, the state continued to provide them additional discovery. Frustrated with the process, the defense counsel issued her own subpoena for the Lake Dallas Police Department, seeking any and all materials related to the investigation in this case. The amount of materials the defense counsel received were far greater than the details or the discovery that had been disclosed by the state of Texas or the Lake Dallas Police Department. In fact, contained within those files that were given to defense counsel were emails relating to possible other suspects who had not been followed through, who had not been investigated, of possible evidence via jail phone calls that were flagged by Denton County Sheriff's Office as being important and related to this and sending it to the police department, and the police not knowing what they've done with the files. It could be on their hard drive. It could be on a file they kept. They were unsure. The lead detective in this case did not know where she was keeping evidence and appeared at the end of this case to just fall upon her naivety to justify failing to turn over exculpatory and relevant material under evidence under 3914 to the trial defense in a murder case. What we were looking at is by the time...
Put quite a burden on these police departments, haven't we?
Right, I agree. I believe it's rightfully so. This is a great example of why the police department should have such a heavy burden and the state of Texas. My client, Mr. Brandon Johnson, sat incarcerated with a charge of murder for 1,038 days while Lake Dallas Police Department, who was the one who sent the file to the Denton County District Attorney's Office, which is an indication they have enough information or evidence to move forward with this case and with this charge. And they didn't. 3.5 years later, Lake Dallas Police Department is still trying to figure out where they've put evidence. They don't know if they still have evidence or if they've lost or destroyed evidence. And that's where things get iffy in this case as well.
But we're not supposed to make an analysis of what you already had versus what you don't have, how that impacts something under, I don't even know what analysis to say, a harm analysis, a Heath analysis. How are we supposed to make that balancing act pretrial?
Pretrial, and I think that's exactly what Texas Court of Criminal Appeals was trying to do in State v. Heath. State v. Heath has good intentions. It's an act, an amendment that was put in place with the best of intentions based on the case of Michael Morton. However, the failure to give sanctions has left everybody at a loss. The defense can jump up and down and yell that they are not receiving evidence, whether it be from the district attorney's office or the police department, which Heath tells us doesn't matter, right? They're all one. The DA's office has to make a movement towards the PD to ensure that they are getting all of the evidence. That should be happening at the beginning of a case. That's the purpose of the Michael Morton Act. Once you have the evidence, state of Texas, the fair thing to do is to turn that evidence over, all of it, not just some of the evidence, all of the evidence, so that they have as much time as you do to prepare for this case. But in reality, what we have is police departments sending partial evidence to a DA's office who's indicting a case on these charges, such as murder, incarcerating the defendant, and then the prosecutor who's assigned the case may look at that case a year and a half later and start sending evidence to the defense. That's what happened in this case. And in fact, the state just sent them their disclosure list with the evidence. And the defense counsel, the trial counsel, is the one that had to go through that evidence and then go back to the state and say, you've sent me a list of all of this information, and that is not what is included in the actual evidence you've given me. That's what sparked the DA's office in this case to say, we have to go back to the police and try to find, if we have all the evidence, find all the evidence. That's when the state first decided they were going to make a movement towards the police department and ascertain what was in their actual possession, not just take their word that what they sent to them was everything. The state has a duty to ascertain, to go out and get that information from the Denton County Sheriff's Office, the law enforcement, Lake Dallas PD.
You would agree that the dismissal of the indictment in this case is an extreme remedy?
I believe that historically courts have said that the dismissal of an...
How Heath justifies the extreme remedy in this case and how we're supposed to, on the basis of this record, analyze whether that extreme remedy was warranted.
Absolutely. I understand your question, Your Honor, and let me address that. I believe that State v. Heath did exactly the same thing. In State v. Heath, they were seeking the exclusion of evidence pretrial. The state argued that's a drastic and harsh remedy. Only for the most extraordinary of cases could you ever do such a thing. We've heard the state argue that today. They argued the same thing as to exclusion of evidence pre-trial due to a violation of 39.14. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals said it is a drastic remedy, and under the other law, that's how we treated it. That was the old law applicable of 39.14. But under this law, it is different. The court went through to say that 39.14 was amended, or actually the original enactment of it, was based upon the Texas Civil Rules of Procedure regarding discovery. And in fact, by not providing any sanctions, State v. Heath gave us instructions that we can look toward what the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure have provided.
We should adopt his death penalty sanction standard?
Under
the civil rules, there are very particular findings that have to be made to impose a death penalty sanction. I think that's what he's arguing for. Is that the standard you want us to adopt?
Well, his new this death penalty argument that has been raised today is the first time I've heard the state make this argument.
I'm not saying I'm being fair here, but I still want to hear what you have to say.
I believe that according to State v. Heath, I couldn't say whether it would be foreclosed or not, because according to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, we need to look at, one, the facts of the case, what remedial options are available to the court's own inherent authority to control their dockets, and the issues that are raised by counsel. That was very specific in Heath. They said we're looking at exclusion in this case not to determine whether this was the appropriate remedy, whether the court should have done something lesser, like grant a continuance. Heath said, we're not doing that. That's not what we're here to do. We're here to address the issues that counsel raised based on the facts of the case and that the trial court had before it when they decided among their options and then decided to make their ruling.
You brought up, if he is making a death penalty, civil death penalty argument, he's doing that basically in response to your assertion that because those civil rules lead to a dismissal, and then you analogize and say essentially it's the same thing, it should be the same way in a criminal case, that's really your position, right? Your position was that's your authority, really, is comparing the civil sanctions to the criminal context.
Yes, right? I believe that the trial courts have the authority to look at those options and best decide what fits based on the facts and argument of counsel.
But the problem there, what you concede, is in the civil world, there is no rule that says that a court cannot dismiss a civil action or the petition in a civil action without the consent of the plaintiff. But in the criminal context, there is very solid law that says that a trial judge in Texas cannot dismiss an indictment without the consent of the state. And because you have these competing authorities, it's hard to make that, and you say it's analogous, because there's a piece of law over here in the criminal context that's extremely significant. You agree with that?
I would agree that the language you're referring to about the state's consent is, you know, a factor to play, but I think that State v. Heath kind of addressed that in saying that the state's consent was more applicable to, when we're talking about discovery, to the original 39.14, and that because of the amendment that it is under Michael Morton, that it's changed, and that because we've now statutorily, we did not provide the sanctions, that case law is telling us that we're to nod in that direction of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. I think that what the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals is telling us is things have changed. And things are changing because 39.14 does not contain its own sanctions. So if we are to find that regardless of the amount or the egregiousness of violations by either law enforcement or the prosecutor, that the only remedy is for us to continuously look for a continuance, then there is no reason for the state to continue to show up in this case in 2026 and put more evidence on trial defense's desk and ask for another continuance.
Let me stop you right there. So Okay, you have tons of case law.
Right.
Hundreds of years old in the due process context. Then our legislature, doing something that I think was needed to be done, beefs up 3914. But as you point out, there's no sanctions there. And wouldn't you concede that if the legislature, and of course that's what we have to go off, essentially you're using a law to say that this was justified, at least it gives them the inherent authority. But that law doesn't specifically say that a trial judge can dismiss the case for a violation. And if they wanted that to happen, don't you think that would have been enumerated within the statute?
Well, I would like to say yes, but however, as we all know throughout studying criminal law, that there's a lot of things the legislature could or should have done when they make changes or amendments to statutes that are often overlooked. And that's how we end up in this barrage of case law.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
It's equal opportunity.
So I think that State v. Heath, I think that they're trying, that's what exactly what the court was trying to wrestle with, though, is the courts have to be able to have their own authority to control their dockets based on the arguments raised. And when we're looking at discovery, we're looking at something very important and something very different. Something that in the state of Texas that we see on a regular basis of exonerated defendants being released, and this is an attempt to stop that. But without sanctions, we have nothing, and that's why I think State v. Heath said we have to look over here.
Let me ask you kind of a historic, I guess, I don't know, bird's eye view question.
Okay.
Okay. So I agree. I this is not my first rodeo in the criminal world, obviously.
Yes, Your Honor.
And 20 years ago, there was almost no repercussions for holding back exculpatory evidence. It happened a lot. Let's just be clear about that. But then
Agreed.
The state, from a public policy perspective, has started to work to try to chip away at that. I mean, there were prosecutors actually getting disbarred for violations, which was unheard of 20 years ago. And so we see it ratcheting up. I've yet to see, this is the first time I've seen it, a dismissal for a Michael Morton violation, essentially.
I agree, Your Honor. I do believe that this is a case of first impression. And then again, I think that State v. Heath was a case of first impression, especially when they released the published opinion that came down and said that we're going to put some teeth to the Michael Morton Act because we don't have it. And as again, I would just say the intent, I think, is clear from the legislature.
Let me ask you another question. Was the suppression, if you want, I'm using the word suppression not as a term of art, but just as a regular word.
Yes.
The suppression of this evidence, essentially.
In this case,
would it have been dispositive? In other words, could the state have had a prosecution without the items that essentially, we're really not sure what all it entailed, but the items that you believe were held back and that ultimately were turned over and were not handed over when they were supposed to be from the state?
Well, I would say that the state would probably at almost any stage in this proceeding have said they had enough to go forward on, and that's the exact problem and why we have the Michael Morton Act, because the evidence at issue here is evidence favorable to the defense. So the state would be happy to have any of this evidence excluded. The evidence we're talking about are third part co-defendants identifying a possible different Brandon Johnson than the man sitting in Denton County Jail. They're identifying someone in Collin County from a Collin County mugshot, and our man is not in the Collin County database.
Yeah, it's defensive stuff typically.
It's defense,
and I get that.
And exclusion is not a remedy.
Will it prevent the defense from being able to put a case on chief on potentially? I mean, these are all variables that you have to consider. But the question, I guess, would be, would this case have moved forward, and would there still be a defense and all these things had it not, I mean, if all the trial judge had instead would have said, okay, you're not going to be able to use that evidence.
Yeah.
The state won't, defense
and
can.
I think that's the appellee and many defense counsel would argue that is the problem. The exclusion of evidence is most likely when the state asks for it is because it's something that they don't need or because it was helpful to the defense. And that is the exact problem with the lack of any sanctions under Michael Morton. We're to require another continuance, which allows them to keep berating or slowing down the process, or we can have the evidence which is favorable to the defense excluded. I'm so sorry, Judge.
I just, before we're out of time, I wanted you to answer the question that I also asked Mr. Whitten. From this record, how can we tell what discovery was delayed, what was destroyed, what was lost? Because at the beginning of this hearing, wasn't a lot of discovery tendered to Mr. Johnson's attorneys at that time, and it hadn't even been reviewed? So from our perspective, from this record, how can we tell that? And isn't that distinction important when you're deciding what remedy to impose?
Absolutely. And just if I have, it's 10 seconds if you want me to finish. Okay. At the end, prior to the trial court making his ruling, he had defense counsel list the items that she felt were still missing, lost, or destroyed based on what she had reviewed at that time. Again, we can't know for certain what all was produced that day because the DA's office produced more discovery on the same day the case was dismissed. And also not in the record, I believe, that there's a lot not in the record. And I would argue that it's also that there's continuing discovery even after the dismissal of this indictment. And so there's no end in sight. And I believe that this is the case that has shown egregious facts. It doesn't have to be bad faith. They tell us in Heath it's willful. Willful is when you don't ascertain the discoverable evidence in a timely manner. The state has conceded that didn't happen here. The trial court did utilize it in a continuance in this case for 5 months. Were they to use another one for another 5 months and go past 1,038 days of my client still being incarcerated while we played games and cited that there is no remedy or repercussion?
He has a speedy trial remedy, doesn't he?
And, Your Honor, we would argue, trial counsel's argument as to that, they weren't going to seek a motion for continuance to further the situation because it would harm any speedy trial that they would have sought had they been denied the dismissal of the indictment. However, they were granted the dismissal, but they do believe that further arguments to give additional time would weigh against them in a Barker analysis. So trial counsel really felt their hands were tied. They're on a murder case. They don't have evidence. Time is up. If I would get a continuance or we make affirmative actions, it could harm a speedy trial violation. They're caught in the crosshairs. We do need assistance and carry Heath one step further. This is the case that does that. Thank you so much for your time.
Tell the court in the future how to apply this standard.
I'm sorry?
What standard do we tell our sister courts to apply in?
If we decide to basically be the legislature in this sense.
Well, I think State v. Heath points out the four factors that they considered in this case, which was the argument of counsel, the facts of the case, the remedial options available, and I forget the fourth one, but they outlined it in four that they thought they considered in determining whether or not the trial court acted appropriately. And I argue that, again, it's the argument of counsel that really plays an important factor to counsel asked for the dismissal, and that's what this court is to determine, is whether or not that was the appropriate result or whether he abused his discretion in doing so. I believe State v. Heath says that we have proved everything necessary other than just the correct language the trial court would have gained from Heath. We would ask that you affirm the trial court's dismissal of the indictment. In this case, thank you again for your time.
Mr. Justice Walker, you asked a really perceptive question, which was we have a civil set of rules that the Heath Court pointed to, and then you have this long-standing set of criminal law jurisprudence. So what is the standard we apply? Well, we agree Heath is the case that guides the decision-making here. And in this case, what can we look to? There are three things. Look at the alternate remedies that would have been available short of dismissal. Exclusion, if they don't want it excluded because it's favorable to them, that's fine. They're welcome to use it. It's apparent from the record that the attorney's identification of this other Brandon Johnson was probably an error, but that's neither here nor there right now. But they're welcome to use it. They're welcome to use anything. And the trial court could do spoliation instructions or other remedies that could even direct a jury to find affirmatively or negatively on certain issues. Those are remedies available to the trial court under Heath. That's apparent. The second thing...
Have you ever seen a spoliation instruction in a Texas criminal jury trial?
No, Your Honor, I have not.
I have not either.
But it seems like under Heath, maybe that's a possibility. The second thing is, look at situations where there really was authority for a trial court to dismiss an indictment without consent. Those situations are exceedingly rare and involve a due process violation that is serious, which we do not have here. Now, third, you are not going to find a case, I don't believe, a Texas case, where a statutory violation warranted dismissal of a criminal indictment. It's not out there, at least as far as I know. So I think that the court can look to those three things and determine that the trial court did not have inherent authority here to dismiss the indictment under 3914.
Now tell me, in reading this, I'm trying to refresh my memory. I've been thinking about this for a time being. There's actually, it's codified in the Code of Criminal Procedure that the judge cannot make it grant a dismissal. Isn't that right? Isn't it actually in the code? I was thinking about that.
Oh, gosh, Your Honor.
Yeah.
I'm not prepared to answer that question.
Yeah, no, it's
right
okay.
Now.
It's okay, because I can't remember either.
I can't remember.
But
I'd
vaguely
like
remember.
Back and look.
I think I've read it, but it's been a while.
I do know what the jurisprudence says,
sure.
We all know.
We all know that.
And the jurisprudence says that it is an extreme remedy, dismissal of a criminal indictment. I do take issue with counsel's statement that Mungia in those cases are outdated. They do involve due process claims, and 3914 is a statutory creature.
But her position was that they pertain to 3914 before the amendments. Mm-hmm. And you do concede that that's true, correct?
Yeah, sure. There's no question that the Michael Morton Act created a general right to discovery that goes beyond the bounds of due process. That's language straight from the Heath case. We concede that. And we take no issue with the Heath opinion. As applied to this case, it simply does not warrant dismissal of the indictment. State requests that this appellate court reverse the trial court's dismissal of the indictment. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. We appreciate your arguments, and we'll get back to you.